Aloha, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Good morning, I'm Geraldine Coutts. Welcome to many listeners right across the region, and we've got some breaking news for you to start the program this morning. The US Geological Survey is reporting that a 7.9 magnitude earthquake has hit just off the coast of American Samoa, just 180 kilometres from Hi'ipo in Tonga and 200 kilometres from Samoa's capital Apia. And just moments ago, the quake was upgraded by the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre to an 8.3 magnitude quake. Niue, Wallace and Futuna, Tokelau and Cook Islands are also within a short distance of the quake and a possible tsunami, as is the top end of New Zealand. Reports are still coming in, but the massive quake was also very shallow at 21 miles under the surface, and the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre has issued a tsunami warning for American Samoa, New Zealand and all regional Pacific states. And first, we're going to the Pacific Warning Centre in Hawaii for the latest on the initial warnings that were issued less than an hour ago. And we're joined by Nathan Becker, who's an oceanographer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now then, what is your latest news? How up-to-date is that information we've just relayed?
It sounds to me like you have our most recent bulletin, which only went out a few minutes ago, which is good news. It's good news that you have it. What I can add to that is that we did record a tsunami in American Samoa and Western Samoa on our instrumentation there. In Western Samoa, it was about 0.7 meters, 7/10 of a meter, and in American Samoa is 1.5 meters. So we know the tsunami has been generated, but we have not yet determined which way it's headed, if it's headed out in the open ocean or not. But you're quite correct. Those the islands nearby are in a tsunami warning.
Because one of the original warnings also included Fiji, so is it right across to east to west Pacific that are on standby now?
Fiji is still in a warning. We base our warning on the travel time of a tsunami, how fast it moves through the water. And so the areas that are within a 3 hours of arrival of a wave, we put into a warning, and that includes the islands you mentioned.
Okay, so how fast is this one moving?
Tsunamis in the open ocean move quite fast. I'm trying to make the conversion in my head, but it's on the order of several hundred kilometers per hour. They move very fast in deep water.
Okay, so American Samoa and Western Samoa are probably in the front line of this one this time around.
Right, they were the first to receive the waves, and so we're waiting to see if the wave shows up at any other instruments, both shore-based and out in the deep water. Those are the buoys to see if there's a wave headed anywhere.
Now, how big were the waves that hit both Western and American Samoa?
Western Samoa got a 7/10 of a meter, and American Samoa got 1.5 meters, almost 1.6 meters. Those are big enough to be dangerous. If you were on the shore, if such a wave came in, that could sweep you off your feet. It could damage boats in the harbor. It could flood low-lying areas. So Samoa is certainly an area that was likely to have experienced some damage. A similar wave arriving anywhere else would pose a similar threat.
Now, has your bureau been in touch with American or either of the Samoas to have a chat to them about what's going on and what impact they have actually experienced?
I was on the phone earlier when the earthquake happened with an official in American Samoa. They felt the earthquake. They knew there was a large earthquake, and I expect that they self-evacuated before we even got a message out because they were right there. But I don't have reports of damage or injuries.
Now, do we need to be more concerned? I mean, it's worrying for everyone, but do we need to be more concerned about the low-lying atolls who already experience devastation just from regular high tides, such as Tuvalu and Kiribati?
Not necessarily. Much of the damage depends on the seafloor topography around the island, whether it has reefs, number of things like that. So we put these areas in the warnings to err on the side of caution, but some of the islands may not see anything at all, even if they're right in the middle of the wave. It's just a artifact of the physics of seawater that behaves that way. Shorelines that have the right kind of seafloor structure offshore could actually amplify a wave. So we're just being very cautious about this.
Okay. Now, it was an earthquake, 7.9 magnitude. Are we going to expect aftershocks from this size earthquake?
I would think so. Something this big, and we think it was pretty shallow in the Earth, those are likely to have aftershocks. We've actually, I think you mentioned in your introduction, we've upgraded the magnitude to an 8.3 based on the information we have. That's a very large earthquake, and it's very likely to have aftershocks.
And what impact would that have on a tsunami?
A very large aftershock can be just as dangerous as a main shock, but aftershocks by definition are smaller than the original shock, so there might be risk near the epicenter, but as they will be smaller than the original earthquake, any potential waves would also be smaller.
Now, one of the problems in the Pacific, as we've seen with tsunamis in the past, and the one in the Solomon Islands, is the information doesn't get through, so it comes as quite a shock to the locals. Have we improved on that? Is the information getting out? Because this virtually is Pacific-wide.
I believe so. As I mentioned, we talked to Samoa directly by phone. We have numerous circuits that send information out also by phone and by fax. Electronically, we contact our American State Department, and they convey messages. There's been a lot of improvements in the system in the last several years.
Okay, so Nathan Baker, what happens now? Are you just on watch and on standby? Is that what you do now?
Right now, we are waiting for more data to come in from our sea level gauges so we can measure any tsunami that's out in the water to see how big it is and which way it's headed. For example, it could be headed to Hawaii instead of New Zealand, and we would have to be aware of that. Or the reverse could be true. Tsunamis have a very directional property. They don't spread out like ripples in the pond. It's more like a log being rolled into a pond where they have parallel directional waves going just one direction. So once we determine that direction, we can start making a much more refined forecast for the waves.
Okay, look, how long will it take you to find out or get the information back from those gauges?
Well, it's ongoing, and right now we have many scientists in the room with me working on this, but I would expect we'd have a better answer within an hour.
All right. Look, Nathan Baker, we'll let you get back to it, and do you mind if we call you back in a little while just to check up and get an update from you on what's happening so that we can warn our listeners as well?
Yes.
Okay. Nathan Baker, who's an oceanographer in with the survey, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center in Hawaii. Thank you, and we'll speak to you later.
Okay. Goodbye.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Good morning. Just a pretty rough way to start the program. I hope all of you who are listening now are safe and well, and we'll keep bringing you updates as we get them to keep you informed as well. Some of the largest battles that raged in the Pacific during World War II happened around Papua New Guinea's Bougainville, where Allied forces fought desperately to repel the Japanese from taking the top end of Australia. More than 60 years later, thousands of unexploded weapons, ammunition and explosives litters Bougainville, limiting locals' ability to pursue even basic subsistence farming due to the dangers. Abandoned World War II ordnance has also been scavenged from Bougainville and used by militant groups and criminals over the years. So in response to a request from the government of Papua New Guinea in January this year, the US State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement is assessing how to remove these weapons. Their quick reaction force has now deployed to Torokina District on Bougainville. Charles O. Stone Cipher is in the Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement with the U.S. Department of State, and he joins us now from Washington. Good afternoon to you.
Hello, Geraldine. Glad to be with you.
Now, this is a pretty big job, but firstly, can I just ask you about the Quick Reaction Force? What does that consist of, and how does it work?
Yes, this office in the State Department funds humanitarian demining and unexploded ordnance clearance and a couple score of countries around the world. One of the ways that we do it is by dispatching this quick reaction force, which is composed of civilian explosive ordnance experts, on contract to the State Department to be used for quick purposes. They aren't for prolonged projects like long-term mine clearance, say, in Southeast Asia, but for quick projects, they're perfect, and they're the ones that we've sent in to take a survey of Torokina.
Okay, so what has the survey shown you?
So far what we know is that when U.S. and Australian forces left the area in 1945, finally, at the end of the war, there was a cleanup conducted, but that a lot of ordnance was left behind. a lot of stuff that had been fired and had failed to explode, but also a lot of ammunition that was simply left by old mortar pits and artillery positions. And this ammunition, including lots of small arms ammunition, litters the area, and it's been limiting the ability of the farmers to farm and to plant their cocoa trees to harvest, and it's been causing civilian casualties. The team that's there now has been mapping the locations of the bigger accumulations of this material, and they've also been interviewing the locals to find out where they consider the areas to be highest priority for any future clearance activities.
Now, can you just give us an idea of how much we're talking about? I mean, is it a dozen, 100?
We're talking probably at least 100 different sites that might have anywhere from 20 to 100 mortar rounds, for example. These are all over the place. The area is very heavily forested, largely, so it's hard to reach these places. I made a trip there in June myself as part of a very initial couple-day look around, and just in that period of time fanning out through the woods and being shown by the villagers where things were, I myself saw probably 20 or 30 significant piles of World War II ammunition.
Piles?
Piles.
Now, because they've been there for such a long time, it's not going to be an easy task. You'd expect that the firing mechanisms and stuff are a bit dodgy now, so it's going to be hard to dismantle.
Yeah, we would typically not even try to dismantle them. Most of them would be detonated. EOD technicians, explosive ordnance disposal technicians, would go in, set charges, make sure that everyone was clear of the area, and simply blow the stuff up. Because you're exactly right; it's way too dodgy to try to take these things apart.
And so, what kind of terrain is this in? You'd expect, being Bougainville, that it's not going to be easy work.
It's, as it happens, the area that the U.S. and Australian forces operated out of at Torquina is a large, fairly flat basin. It's surrounded by very rough terrain, and the Australian forces fought back through that very rough terrain. But the main area that we're concentrating on is fairly flat, and it's where there were three Allied airfields built during the war. Like I say, it's heavily timbered now and largely overgrown, but it's not as rugged as it is a little bit farther inland.
So obviously because of the airports, there were munitions dumps nearby. So you're expecting that this is the only area, Torquina? There aren't other areas that might have similar amounts of munitions dumped there?
This will be far and away the largest area on Bougainville. This was the largest Allied base, Torquina was. And it's also the site of the largest land battles with the Japanese forces. Farther inland, there will indeed be other areas, and there would certainly be some, you know, an expectation that you'd find, for example, Japanese ammo dumps in other parts of the island. But this will certainly be by far the largest concentration.
Sounds like a dangerous and big job. Charles A. Stonecipher, Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement with the U.S. Department of State, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat today to explain it all to us.
No, thank you very much, and really looking forward to seeing how the project turns out.
Pacific Beat.
Yes, it is. And you're tuned to ABC Radio Australia. Good morning. I'm Geraldine Coutts, and it's 6:23 in Vanuatu. And Vanuatu's Supreme Court has dropped a case against two members of parliament over their alleged involvement in harbouring escaped prisoners. Last December, after the burning down of the country's main prison, Moana Carcasses Kalasil and Ralph Reganvanu were charged with harbouring prisoners, being accessories after the fact and being complicit in the escape. If they had been found guilty, the men would have been forced out of Parliament. But on Friday, Vanuatu's public prosecutor applied to the Supreme Court to have the charges dropped due to a lack of evidence. Ralph Reganvanu has told Pacific correspondent Campbell Cooney while they expected the charges to be dropped, they did not expect it to happen so soon.
Basically, the public prosecutor made an application for nolle prosequi, to withdraw all the charges based on insufficient evidence. And this was The court heard the application to withdraw the charges on Friday, and the court accepted. We were expecting that this may happen. It was, in fact, earlier than we expected. The hearing was supposed to be on the 12th of October, at which time we were expecting at least one of the charges to be withdrawn because the public prosecutor had informed the judge that she was going to withdraw at least one of the charges. But it seems that a conference was held last week, and the public prosecutor, in fact, decided that all of the charges would be withdrawn, and so the judge moved the date forward just to get the case off our backs.
What's going on now? Are you going to take this further?
We have been consulting with our lawyers about whether we should take another step towards getting something back from the government in terms of to cover our legal costs, or in terms of defamation, or the the reputational damage to our names. But we're still negotiating about that, and we don't know whether we will or not. I mean, they obviously weren't justified, and the withdrawal of the charges has shown that it was a completely misplaced allegation. You know, it's for us, we're glad that justice has won out in the end, and I think it's shown that it is possible for justice to win out, although, you know, some may doubt it in Vanuatu sometimes. But we're just happy about that. Yeah, we will see what happens regarding any further actions.
When you and I spoke earlier this year, you said that certainly part of the issue and part of the charges was you were raising concerns about the state of prisons in Vanuatu and the conditions for prisoners. Are you going forward with those concerns?
Well, actually, I think that as a result of what happened on the 19th of December last year, when the prison was burnt down and the detainees all escaped and we rounded them up again, a lot has been done to address those issues. The government has, in fact, done a lot to address the issues of the safety of the prisons, treatment of prisoners. And so now it looks as though we have a very good system in place. It's an interim system because they're still waiting to construct the new correctional facility, which will deal with issues such as separating high-risk, low-risk prisoners on a facility, having rehabilitative facilities, having areas for food gardens and that kind of thing. But with the interim facilities that are in place, they have actually separated the high-risk prisoners from medium-risk and low-risk. They've also renovated extensively all the existing facilities, so they're no longer in the state they were. And the care of prisoners has been handed back from the police back to the Department of Correctional Services, who are actually trained in the proper treatment of prisoners, because at the time when the prison break occurred, they were under the hands of the police, which was not really what was meant to be happening.
Vanuatu MP Rolf Reganvanu speaking there with Campbell Cooney. Australia Today embarks on the biggest vaccination rollout in its history as shots for the H1N1 are offered to people across the country. The Australian government says those most at risk of coming down with swine flu should be among the first to receive the vaccine, including pregnant women, people with cancer, heart disease or diabetes. But a leading influenza expert has accused one of his peers of raising undue concerns about the swine flu vaccine. Alison Caldwell reports.
According to the most recent figures, 178 Australians died after contracting swine flu this winter. There have been 36,500 confirmed cases. From today, Australians aged 10 years and over will be able to receive a vaccine to protect themselves from swine flu for free from their GP.
Even if you are fit and well, you could still be at risk or infect more vulnerable people.
Australia is one of the first countries in the world to roll out a mass vaccination plan, but medical opinions differ on whether this is the best way to combat another possible wave of the virus.
Alison Caldwell reporting. And now it's time to farewell our friends through the World Radio Network. Thank you very much for your company. See you again tomorrow. Toodaloo. Now just back to the story that we led this program with this morning. An earthquake of magnitude 7.9, which has now been upgraded to 8.3, struck off the South Island nation of Samoa early hours of this morning. That's according to the US Geological Survey. And at a depth of 85 kilometres, that's 53 miles beneath the sea, the quake was strong enough for the Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre to issue a tsunami warning for a large swathe of the South Pacific, including Fiji, New Zealand and Tonga. In a preliminary earthquake report received by the AFP this morning, the gauges at the epicentre is 204 kilometres, that's 130 miles southwest of Samoa's capital and main city, Apia. The tsunami warning was also in effect for American Samoa, Samoa, Niue Islands, Wallace and Futuna Islands, Tokelau Atolls, the Cook Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, the Karamanda Islands, the Baker Howland Islands, Jarvis Island, French Polynesia and the Palmyra Islands.